introduction, so you know we're jumping in the middle again in 1600, so we have to like look around the Jewish world. So last week we were looking at Jews in Poland, which was majority of Jews, majority of Ashkenazi Jews already hit Poland by this time, probably as early as 1550, but certainly by 1600, a clear majority of Ashkenazi Jews are in Poland. A little later, it'll be a majority of Jews in the world will be in Poland. Now, it's an important, very important historical detail, is that there is the Polish-Lithuanian Union in 1386, when the Polish king had one daughter and no sons. So his daughter had to marry somebody in order to have a king. So it was a question of should she marry a fellow by the name of Jagiellon. Jagiellon. Yes. I have no idea. It's not my phone anyway.
Well, that was a recorder.
Yeah, it was. Okay. Yeah. So she married Jagiellon, who was a Jagiellon, who was a Lithuanian. Yeah, actually, until that point, the Lithuanians were pagan until 1386. They were the last major pagan nation in Europe. And there was a Poland and Lithuania.
What? The Vikings were.
Who?
The Vikings. The
Vikings were Scandinavians and they converted earlier than that. The Scandinavians converted in the 1200s. Scandinavians. 1386, the last major pagan nation in Europe. So, Poland and Lithuania. Lithuania at the time, I know today, I really should have brought my map, my European map, to show you guys. Does anyone, any of you guys familiar with the European map of Europe? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, how large is Lithuania today?
Very, very small.
Very small. You know, and there's a joke from, you know, that's 80 years ago. Do you know the national symbol of Lithuania? It's a horse on its standing up on its hind legs.
It only has space for its two hind legs.
It only has space. It puts its front legs out. Okay, but in 1386, Lithuania dominated and ruled large parts of, it ruled Belarus, in other words, White Russia, and most of the Ukraine. So in 1386, Lithuania was larger than Poland, and it created a country which was Polish, Lithuanian, Belarusian all together, and until modern times, they weren't exclusive. They were not mutually exclusive nationalities. Now, the Jagiellon dynasty, or Jagiellon dynasty, more or less ruled Poland until 1572, and until the last one of them died, and then Poland created a monarchical republic. Poland created a monarchical republic. What did that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
What does that mean? That doesn't sound like that. Sounds
like,
very.
I mean, is that like Britain, where like the monarchy is there?
No. It's not a constitutional monarchy like Britain. Rather, it's a country which is a monarchy. However, the monarch is elected by the nobility.
By the bourgeoisie, like that.
Say again.
Like in France, by the bourgeoisie.
France would not. The king was not elected by the bourgeoisie in France. It's more like the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire, there were electors. There were initially 7 and 8, and finally 9. There were electors, people who the highest rank of nobility's job was to elect the next emperor. In Poland, it was slightly different. In Poland, the entire nobility had the rights to vote.
Yeah, but that was a joke. I mean, that's why they didn't get anywhere.
Ah, very good. That was a joke, and that's why they didn't get anywhere. Initially, you're right. Eventually, that's what happened. And they also had another rule. Do you know what their other rule was?
That everyone had a vetoing power, and thus they didn't get anywhere with anything.
Okay. There was the right, one of the Polish legal rights was the right of veto. That meant that if any one person raised their hand and says, I don't like him, then nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
Now, that eventually caused a lot of problems. However, it's important to realize that initially it didn't. Initially it didn't, especially as Russia at this point in time is a backward country. Russia is to Poland's east, it's a backward country.
Who was in charge of Russia?
Well, there was first one dynasty of czars who, you know, Ivan the Terrible.
But mean like near the end though?
Ivan the Terrible ruled Russia in the mid-late 1500s. He ruled Russia in the mid-late 1500s. The problem is he killed his own children. And as a result of Ivan the Terrible, Russia fell into the Russia in the late 1500s, and at least 1620-1630 was more or less in a state of civil war and anarchy. Even after that, you know, eventually the Romanov dynasty ruled Russia from the early 1600s until the fall of the Tsars. They were considerably more backwards than Poland. And like Kiev, if you want to prove it, Alexei, who was the first of the Romanovs, he wanted to educate his children. One of the languages he taught them, so they should be educated, was Polish.
Was he the window to the West?
Window to the West is Peter the Great. We're not going to we'll get window to the West as much later on.
Wasn't Peter the Great like 7 feet tall?
I don't know if he's 7 feet tall, but he was quite tall. I can look it up.
Are we going to get to that time period?
Yeah, we definitely will. Okay. Okay, so now, a very important part, I don't remember if I spoke about this last year, of Polish-Lithuanian Jewry is something which is historically known as the Vad Arba Razos. We've heard of that? The Vad Arba Razos?
No.
The Council of the Four Lands. The Council of the Four Lands. Three lands, four lands, five lands. It was the Jews in... Around, it's not clear if, in other words, when Poland changed from being a dynastic monarchy into being an elective monarchy, approximately the same time the Jews were given legal autonomy. The Jews were given legal autonomy. I'm not sure. I didn't have time to verify everything absolutely. The Vad Arba Razos only started meeting in 1580, which is a number of years after. It's a number of years after the beginning of Poland as a republic, as a monarchical republic, but nonetheless the Jews were given largely good autonomy, and the Vad Arba Razos was the legislative body. That's what it's like sort of sometimes represented as. It's not really completely accurate. It's not really. Do you mind closing the door? Outside this. That's not really completely accurate to call the Vad Arba Razos like a legislative body. It was sort of representative. It was more oligarchical than pure legislative, than pure democratic. But it served. I mean, its main purpose, of course, was to collect taxes.
Remind me, what's an oligarchy?
An oligarchy means the wealth that like there's a small group of powerful people who share power, and that's more or less what the Vad Arba Razos was. More or less, let's just go on now. You'll see why I'm saying it's like there's certain criticisms people make. The early Jewish historians had a certain critique of the Vad Arba Razos, which I think is like out of place personally. So let's just go on and get to the critique and go back and understand why I'm saying it. Okay, so one of the most important things, of course, was collecting taxes. How much taxes each place should pay. And that was one of the Vad Arba Razos' biggest jobs, was divvying up the taxes. Now, I didn't have time to track all this down, but the Jews paid the Jews at this time, in the 1500s, in the 1600s, the Jews, let's say, were like 5 or 6% of Poland, but they were paying like 30% of the taxes in Poland. So, I mean, there's like counter-statements, backs and forths, exact accountings, et cetera. So the Jews were paying a large amount of the taxes. It's not really surprising because almost all the commerce, it's like a well-known, well-documented historical fact from the 1600s until the 1800s, that almost all the commerce in Poland was Jewish. Almost all trade and commerce were almost Jewish. So it was not like you shouldn't be surprised that even though Jews were small percentages, they were still paying a lot of taxes. So, they were moving the money around. One of the other major things they dealt with were communal issues and social issues. Communal and social issues that was dealt with in the Vad Arba Razos. That means it goes on both sides. And those social issues are trying to make sure that as many people the legitimate employees possible. That's one side of it. As a result of that, for example, they would make laws. They would make laws in terms of how old you are when you get married, especially if you're male, that you should have some legal occupation before you get married. And we'll see a little later on, historically, there's going to be a lot more problems. I think it's going to change a little. But earlier, in the heyday of Jewish Jewry, which is to say is pre the partition, pre-1750, in the heyday of Polish Jewry, they definitely are. What happened later, post-1750, was people getting married at 14 to 16. It's very common in the 18th, early 1800s.
Well, was that because the social atmosphere was that people were still living at home at some point? I mean, they were.
It was a common, whatever. We'll get there. It's later on. That's when Poland's partition and the majority of Jews end up in the Russian partition, and that creates a lot of problems. And the Russians had a really anti-Semitic agenda, and Cantonist decree, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And indirect opposition was so they got people get married very young, so you can't draft someone who's married. Okay, anyway. But earlier that didn't work that way. And they definitely had rules about, you don't want people married, you couldn't support a family. That's like one of the classic examples of social issues, of trying to, making rules to try to limit the amount of schnorrers going around from place to place, which is, it's like a funny topic, but it's been around for a long time. Jews out there collecting, it's been out there a long time. There's a famous, Jewish-style joke. It's not about Jews, but the Jewish joke goes like this. The Emperor Napoleon said he's going to try every single occupation for 2 weeks. So he tried everything. His baker 2 weeks, his shoemaker 2 weeks. So he tried being a schnorrer. He only did that 1 week. They asked him, Emperor, why did you only do that 1 week? It was so good. If I would have done it the second week, I would have never quit. Yeah. So that's been an old social issue for a long time. Don't think it's like, oh, it's something new. It's not something new. It's been there for a very long time. Okay, now they also had the job of enforcing law. For example, there was, many of the towns, I think I mentioned this last week, many of the towns had the right to not tolerate Jews. Warsaw, Krakow, and many others had the right to not tolerate no Jews allowed. And the Vada Avrotas cooperated with them in enforcing those rules. Yeah, that's like part of the...
Sounds like ghetto.
Yes and no. In other words, it was Jews were really doing well in Poland, and were welcome in 95% of Poland or 98% of Poland. So the 2% they weren't allowed, it was felt by the community that it was for the greater good to cooperate with those people. It's not ghetto police. It's actually interesting. I went last night. It was like really late last night. An old family friend. I only found out after he passed away. It was originally from lunch. He made a video about his experiences in the Second World War, and so I went to his wife's house and watched the video. I spent 2.5 hours. Shabbos is not over. Shabbos is not over that early either. So. Anyway, the kids are so. I don't know. Ghetto police. I don't know. When we went back, I was like my wife. So my wife, all the different issues with the ghettos and this and the human rights. That was a very different issue. That people, the Nazis were openly trying to kill Jews. The Poles were lackadaisical. They weren't there. They were in that period of time, not that anti-Semitic at all. So anyway, okay, what else did they do? Of course, the other thing they tried to do was to uphold the, you know, state, you know, the religious state of people, and therefore not allow people to engage in activities which are immoral, card playing, you know, all sorts of things people like to do. Gambling,
it's not gambling,
partying too much.
It's not gambling if you know your home, man.
That's why it's gambling. That is exactly why it's gambling, because everyone's sure they're going to win. So that was another thing that the Vada Avrotsa is in. Now it's important to realize that without question, the Vada Avrotsa had a lot of weight and respect throughout the Jewish world. We'll get to at least one clear example this year, probably two, in which you could see the Vada Avrotsa, even though it was limited to Poland, but it was highly respected because it met once, it met usually twice a year. And even though it was really led primarily by an oligarchy of lay leaders, but they were in consultation with the rabbanim, they were in consultation with the rabbis, it exerted a lot of influence on the world, Jewish world outside of Poland, and its opinion was respected certainly in Germany, but even in Holland and other places, which most Jews in Holland were not Ashkenazi. If you're not aware of that, well, maybe, I don't know if we'll get to it this week, but no, we'll get to it next week. Anyway, the Vada Avrotsa again was well respected. Now, there's a critique of the Vada Avrotsa that, for example, that, I mean, it didn't provide defense, it didn't, you know, when the Chmielnytsky problems happened, which we'll get to towards the beginning, we're going to hit to, it was totally paralyzed. I mean, look, the Vada Avrotsa was Jewish autonomy. Jewish autonomy in Poland. The Jews were welcome in Poland in a way that they weren't welcome anywhere else. The right to bear arms was not given to Jews. As a matter of fact, it wasn't given to not only to the nobility, in every country in Europe except for England. That's a fact. The right to bear arms. The English are the first ones to come up with the right to bear arms, and they did it as it was a long reaction. There was an English tradition, just let me just finish this in the union, if you don't forget what I said. It was a long reaction to different kings, especially Charles I, attempting to seize power over Parliament. And the way that the British acted, it was traditional that England had a small army, except for in time of war. That was very traditional, but the British Constitution was unwritten, but it was Kilu added as part of British tradition because of the Parliament, because of the wars between the Stuarts and Parliament, the right to bear arms was unofficially added to the English Constitution, and that prevents the government from controlling it. If you have a citizenship who can get up and pull their guns out, or their bows or swords or whatever it is, suppose you, then there's a limit to the you are limited. But that did not exist. That did not exist in Europe. And it certainly was not given to Jews. So it's criticizing the Vada Avrotsa. It's like a very modern, postmodern criticism. There was no way they could have done such a thing. It wasn't Kilu. There was no Havamina for the Havamina, if you understand what I'm saying. In the like more Jewish fashion, yeah.
Did Jews
hold
nobility in Poland?
Did Jews what?
Did Jews hold nobility?
No, Jews did not. Jews were opposed to the state alone. They were the state alone. They had a very positive relationship with the nobility because they made the nobility's estates were and the nobility had the peasants and had large farms and all that commerce was going to Jews. And the Jews and nobility got on quite well in Poland almost all the time. As a matter of fact, many later observers, early modern period, accused the nobility of plotting with the Jews to keep the Polish peasantry down. Okay. Now we're going to go on and start looking at non-Ashkenazic Jewry. Yeah, we we're going to look at non. It's very important.
Why?
Non-Ashkenazic.
Is anyone Spartan here?
We have Nathan is half Spartan. Okay, now I've said for a long time ago, it's an Ashkenazic fallacy to call all non-Ashkenazims fine. That's an Ashkenazic fallacy. It's not really true. If we'll get, I'll try, and maybe I'll try to go over to the S place. There should be some officially in this year. We have to get some.
Vice versa also.
Say again.
Also fallacy for all parties involved.
No. That's not true. Again, that's why I pointed out beginning this week and last week that Ashkenazi, the German and Polish, German, Polish, Russian, Lithuanian, Hungarian, Austrian, all those Jews are very closely connected.
We should go on a field trip.
Very closely
connected.
Say again?
We should go on a field trip to meet all the different Jews.
Okay. Doesn't Ashkenazi mean Germany though?
It does. But all again, that's we started out. All Jews we call Ashkenazi originally came from Germany.
Well, from Russia.
They moved east. Russia conquered Poland and we kept that's gonna take some time to get there. And then they got a lot of Jews. The Jews just moved to Russia whether they were allowed to or not. Okay. We say it is true, unfortunately I don't have the quote here. But and there are scrolls we've shown them. And the person who wrote it, by the way, is a responsible historian. He says, it might be true that all non-Ashkenazi Jewry should not be called Sephardi. I'm not maybe sure, but it's definitely true. The term Sephardi means someone from Spain. Okay? Nathan's mother, she may be aware of that, but I think it's thinking what we're saying. Nathan's mother is from Iran, from Persia. Okay? A very, very small amount. Persia Jewry is large, by the way. What? Are you living great? Ashkenazi, you're living great. Okay. Persian Jewry is massive. And if you add in Bukharians, who are like, you can. I'm sorry, he doesn't like it, but they speak Bukharian and Persian, or Bukharian to Persian.
What is
it? French Canadian Canadian French to Parisian French.
Okay.
Don't be stuck with that.
Okay, anyway, the case of Persian Jewry is massive. Persian Jewry is massive. One of the largest of the Edot of Jewish communities. Very large, massive. I would estimate that it can't be more than 0.5% Sephardim. Yotzei Sephardim. Okay? Now, we Ashkenazim still call non-Ashkenazi Jews Sephardim. And there's a reason for it. In other words, it's not really accurate.
No.
How many Yotzei Sephardim have you met?
Right.
No. I know. I have an old friend. He's actually today, he's Mashkiach by Rabbi Center. He's 100% Sephardi, Rabbi Maimon. He's 100% Sephardi, and he is lighter than me with blue eyes also.
Nice.
Okay? And he's 100% Sephardi.
Is it accurate to call all
Sephardi? Edut Mizrach and Sephardi. That's what I was about to say.
What's
Edut Mizrach? Edut Mizrach means congregation, Jewish congregations of the East. That is Persia, Iraq, and those areas. That is where those are Edut Mizrach. You maybe could call it Yemen, it's its own thing. It's really its own thing. And they're not, they're okay, now, why is it though that we Ashkenazim like to call all non-Ashkenazim Sephardim? The answer is very simple. Is even though Sephardi Jewry was depending on where, in other words, in Persia, it's not more than 0.5%. It's almost not, I've never met a Persian who says, I got one, but I'm not even sure if I did. My grandmother was really from Cambridge, Liverpool. I've never met her. Everyone's from Persia. They've been from Persia. They've been from Persia for thousands of years, 2,500 years as far as they know. You don't need it. However, in a cultural sense, the Mediterranean basin where the Yotzei Sephardim moved to.
What's Yotzei Sephardim?
Yotzei Sephardim means Spanish exiles. They dominated in a cultural fashion the older communities they lived in. They were more cultured, more educated. A large percentage of the rabbinim or the rabbis were Yotzei Sephardim. And as a result, it depends where it's going to be. In other words, we get some SYs over here. See, SY, the Aram Sovo. That's where they, you know, it's also called this, Aleppo. It seems to me about 20% goes this far. It might be even less than that. It's been pretty exists for ages. But the Rabbanim were almost all Yotzei Tzfat. The Rabbanim were almost all Yotzei Tzfat. So they were other places in Turkey. We're gonna, I don't, maybe we'll get there tonight. Maybe not. Turkey was even more. There's more Yotzei Tzfat in Turkey. So Rabbi David is originally from Salon. That he is of his father's from Salon. His grandfather was a chacham, was a rabbi in Salonika. He was 100% Yotzei Tzfat. Now, what happened in Spain? I want to go over this quickly because it's very important for the period we're going to start with. Very important. Now, anyone know when the Jews were expelled from Spain?
1492.
Does anyone know when the real... That's true. That is absolutely true. But does anyone know, and Nathan, if you remember, you know, I'm on the side, does anyone know when the real beginning, real end of Spanish Jewry was?
1460.
No, I'm not talking about the Inquisition. The Inquisition was instituted in 1482. Now, the Jews were only expelled in 1492. But why did they have to have an Inquisition 10 years before?
Wasn't it something like they thought...
What was the Inquisition? Why did the Spanish start the Inquisition?
To convert.
No, because Spanish Jewry was like on the downhill, and then they like needed someone. They thought there were like secret Jews or something.
There were secret Jews. There absolutely were. There were. Whatever. Okay. So like this, 1391 is the real Kielu. 1391, there were massive anti-Jewish pogroms throughout Spain. Massive anti-Jewish pogroms throughout Spain, and a very large amount of Spanish Jews were either forced to convert or converted. Under duress, you know, under half force or partial force or whatever it was. Now, that's 1391, the end of the real, you know, we call the Rishonim, the real and the last Rishonim who are, you know, willing to fight with the early Rishonim are the Ron, and says Talmidim not as much, but partial. Now the Ron died in around 1370, and the Ron's Talmidim died around 1400. The Rishonim from Spain basically don't exist. The Jews in Spain for another 100 years. So this was raised up in 1391. There were massive anti-Jewish pogroms. A large amount of Jews converted. A large amount left. Of course, because it's pre-modern, we don't really know how much. No one can know. There are numbers thrown out, but they're not really that accurate. But this is really the beginning of the end of Spanish Jewism. This 100 years earlier. Now, a lot of Jews who converted. I mean, some of them who converted to 1391 were serious about it, but most of them were not that serious. And because of that, they instituted the Spanish Inquisition. 1480.
That's where they're like searching out Christians who were like.
The conversos, they call them conversos.
Right.
They call them conversos. Because it only became an issue in 1482. And we're talking about an event which happened 90 years earlier. It wasn't, and that's at least three generations, if not four. It obviously wasn't that clear who really wasn't Jewish. I mean, some of the people who converted were Jews about it. So it wasn't 100% clear. It caused a lot of friction in Spain. And they came up with something called pure Spanish blood. But a lot of people, especially cynical Jewish historians, say there are very few Spaniards who have pure Spanish blood. Anyway, okay, now, I can't, this is just such a juicy historical nugget, I can't resist saying it. We were aware who united Spain. He was sort of
Ferdinand
and Isabella. We're aware of that. Ferdinand Isabella, Spain was only united in 1834, for the records. Legally, Spain was three or four countries until 1834. There was the Kingdom of Castile, and the Kingdom of Aragon, and I believe it was called the County of Barcelona. And there were three legal entities. Happened to be that after Ferdinand and Isabella married each other in 1469, And part of their marriage contract was their children, regardless of gender, will rule everything. And as a result of that, so Spain was sort of, was what, just call it unified, it's not 100% accurate. It's largely accurate, but it's not 100% accurate. In our terms, it's going to be because Ferdinand, who was really king of Aragon, and only a regent in Castile. Castile was the majority in Spain, and Aragon was a minority. But because he liked the Spanish Inquisition so much, he liked the Castilian Inquisition so much, he imported it into Aragon. That is what's really important. That's the short one. But this was what the historical nugget is. Is it wasn't so clear. It was without going through all the dynastic details. Isabella's claim to the throne was not 100% clear. And there were complications. And Jewish bankers played a major part in making the shidduch and getting everyone to sign contracts saying that these people were going to rule Spain, because at the time they got married, Isabella was one of the claimants to the Castilian throne, not actually the ruler. And these Jewish, well-meaning Jewish bankers thought that if they make this shidduch, then Ferdinand and Isabella will be very friendly to them. And they were unfortunately highly mistaken. They were going against, as I said, this is one of the classic historical proofs, that which I told you last week and or the week before, that in Christian countries, when the Jews are needed, that's, they're better to us. When we're not needed, we're not better. So when you have two different countries who are opposing each other, each one has some Jews. When the Jews have money, so each one needs the Jews, they can be better to you. When you combine them, they don't need you as much, and they won't be as good to you. And especially add in 1491, Ferdinand conquers, even again, Ferdinand's really the king of Aragon, but he conquers Granada, which is part of Castile. But once he does that, he doesn't need the Jews anymore. 1492, the Jews are thrown out. The approximations are, of course, no one knows 100%. Again, pre-modern era. But people believe one-third went to North Africa. North Africa, Italy, the parts of Italy that they were going to be allowed to go to, and all the way over, we definitely know the Jews made it, Jews made it all the way to the Ottoman Empire. One-third of them stayed. And one third of them went to Portugal. Yeah.
So a while back, I read a book called Crocodile Island. Crocodile Island. It was about all the kids being sent to the Spanish islands. Is that true? I mean, they claim a bunch of the kids were taken away from their parents and sent to the Spanish islands together. That way,
they would be able to educate the people better. When is it placed?
Around 1492.
I don't know. I'd have to see the details before I can say if it's... Okay. Now, one-third went to Portugal. The one-third who went to Portugal... No one knows the exact numbers. Let's say, some people say 70,000, some people say the traditional number was 150,000. And again, it's very hard to quantify to 100%. What happens like this, the one-third who went to Portugal are very key. Because in 1497, the king of Portugal wanted to marry the daughter, Isabella's daughter. He wanted to marry Isabella's daughter. And Isabella said, you can marry my daughter. On one condition. That you would expel all the Jews from Portugal. Now, the Spanish monarchs, especially Isabella, and Isabella's title historically is Isabella the Catholic. The very religious Catholic. But that is one of her titles. Isabella the Catholic. It's like, Philip II of the Armada is called the Prudent. This guy's called this, this guy's called that. She's called the Catholic. So she was a religious woman. Catholic religious, but she was a religious woman. The Portuguese are not known to be as religiously scrupulous as the Spanish. It's always true. But Manuel figured it's a good job. He was hoping. See, then there's again. There's the Portuguese and the Spanish had intermarried a number of times, and each one was hoping that the other dynasty is going to die out, and their dynasty is going to rule the entire peninsula. That's what each side's hoping is going to happen. I mean, it happened in England. That's what happened to the English and the Scots. That's how England conquered Scotland. England absorbed Scotland via dynastic moves. So Manuel, king of Portugal, was helping to do the same thing. So he accepted the shidduch, but he had a problem. Portugal at that time was developing an international empire, a trade empire. But he also was not as wealthy as a country, not as large and substantial a country as Spain. And he did not want to lose all that Jewish money. So his brilliant solution was force all those Jews to convert. Unlike the Spanish, who gave Jews, they said, okay, whenever they made their decree, okay, 3 months or 5 months or 2 months or whatever it is, you have 3-5 months to either leave or convert. Manuel did not do that. He said, okay guys, next week you're converting. That's it. And they would force a tequila to convert someone to Christianity. All you have to do is dump them in the baptismal font, baptismal waters, and they are now Christian. Now, because they weren't as religiously scrupulous, he's not known as the Catholic, they said, okay, you know, okay, Christian now, you're legal Christian, but what you do in your own homes, we're going to keep, or we're not going to, unofficially, they told him, what you do in your own homes is your own business. And this is the real historical Muranos are almost all of Portuguese descent. They're almost all really Portuguese, Spanish, pure Spanish, according to historians. And I didn't double check their work, but according to Stan, I didn't see anyone who argued on the ones who said it, so you also said we see different opinions. But they say that if you look at the Inquisition kept pretty good records, and you could look at the records and see where the people were from, and the original group of conversos, of forced conversions, and trials because of it in Spain die out in the 1520s. Because again, the facts are that the Jews who stayed in Spain, most of them weren't as religious. They weren't. The ones who really didn't want to be Christian left. And a lot of them left to Portugal. So the Jews in Portugal who forcibly converted were people who were more serious about their Judaism. And this is going to create the great historical, you know, phenomenon of Muranos. Now there were fluctuations. The way the Portuguese, again, it's not, this is like sort of simplification to say they said just do what you want. There were fluctuations, ons and offs, depending on different happenings. But basically, until 1580, things were fine. Basically, until 1580, things were fine. Okay, what happened in 1580? 1578, King of Portugal, whose name was Sebastian, decides to make a crusade and attempt to conquer Morocco. Not only an absolute failure, he died, and a large amount of the Spanish of the Portuguese nobility died also. He had it was either an uncle or a brother who ruled for 2 years, but then after that, one of the strongest claims to the throne is Philip II of Spain. Philip II of Spain is one of the strongest claimants to the throne. Now he knows he's in a very delicate, difficult situation. On one hand, he was the closest claimant to the throne. The other side of the story is that Portuguese don't like Spanish. Portuguese don't like Spanish at all. And many historians believe the only reason why he was able to take control of Portugal was because so many Portuguese nobility died in Morocco with the King of Portugal. So he moved slowly and carefully. He's called the Prudent. He's not called the Prudent for nothing. He moved slowly and carefully, and in 1581 he was crowned King of Portugal. That makes a major. Now we have a bombshell, because it was until 1581. Things were, the Portuguese Muranos, crypto Jews, they weren't looking into what they're doing, and most of the time they were able to do what they wanted. It's a very interesting question, which I've been looking into for at least a year now, and I'm willing to wait on something like this for a very long time. How knowledgeable these Jews were specifically, in other words, did they know Hebrew? Did not know Hebrew? How many Sephardim did they have? These are very interesting questions, which are very hard. It'll be very difficult to prove one way or the other. and it would take a lot of, you know, wide range of proof. Now, what happened though, now that Philip II is ruling Portugal, we have a major problem. Until now, the Spanish Inquisition did not apply to Portugal, and 1580 now it applies to Portugal. And I just want to take one more step. And the one more step is like this. In the great irony, the Spanish Inquisition was strictly enforced in Portugal. But under their own nose, the conversos, the crypto Jews in Spain, had died out a few years earlier. In Spain, it wasn't as well enforced. So a lot of the Portuguese Jews figured that out and moved to Spain. They didn't only move to Spain. Spain ruled, the Spanish crown ruled over half of Italy, ruled the Low Countries, and other places. As a result of this, especially the Low Countries, who were even less religious than the Portuguese, Jews start moving there, crypto-Jews move there, because they know they can get away with what they want. That almost leads one to believe. In other words, there's a well-known legend. I don't know if it's Mamish tribe. I'm not sure if it's historical. There's a well-known legend of the Jews having a private minion in a house in Amsterdam, and the Dutch finding out, thinking they're Catholic, and then they said, no, we're Jewish. So that leads one to believe. It's hard to know if it's really historically accurate. And it's not confused. As long as you're not Catholic, we don't have a problem. So I don't know if there's real historical substance to that famous legend or not, but that would lead one to believe that they're at least you know, they still had knowledge of Siddur, Chumash, and Hebrew, even though again these things are very, you know, very iffy. So this is a very important date. It's funny this book I didn't even realize, 1580, all of a sudden Portuguese Jews start having, you know, Portuguese start moving through Spain and all over the place, and they're like, well, he didn't like figure out why. And the answer is very simple. It's because Portugal was absorbed by Spain. That's how the Portuguese Jews start moving throughout the Spanish Empire. And we'll go on later, next week and afterwards, and see more places they move, and it's going to create, that's a very, very important fact is happening now. So he's leaving?
Huh?
He's leaving?
No.
Small?
Could be. That's like, yeah, I thought you understood.
I understood that from...
He told you.
No, he didn't. But I heard him speaking to Rabbi David this morning.
Oh, yeah.